Lady Shrewsbury's imminent demise. He knew that when Sherlock Holmes's letter to the coroner took effect, Miss Olivia Holmes had been the chief beneficiary. He also knew that Miss Olivia Holmes had a younger sister, who happened to have fallen from grace the exact same day disaster struck Sherlock Holmes. Why he hadn't put two and two together earlier, he didn't know, except that the mind did not go where the mind did not want to go. "You are wound up tight," murmured Alice. He stared into the dark. "Do you think an extraordinary woman ought to be treated differently, my dear?" "Where did that question come from?" Alice chuckled softly. "And treated differently from whom? Other women?"
"Yes."
"And how will this extraordinary woman be treated? As well as a slightly better than average man?"
"Better than that, I hope."
"The extraordinary will always be treated differently. They're extraordinary, after all. What I wonder is whether a not-so-extraordinary woman will ever be treated the same as a not-so-extraordinary man." Something in the tone of his wife's voice made him turn toward her.
"You wonder just now? Or you've long wondered this?"
It caused a strange sensation, almost like panic, to realize that he didn't know this about her. She was silent for some time. "When I was 10, I told Father that someday I would like to run Cousins Manufacturing. He said that would not happen. I loved my father, you know that, and he was a wonderful man. But he was old-fashioned in this matter. He wanted his son to carry on his life's work, even though Barnaby isn't remotely suitable for it. It helped in a way, I suppose, that Father was firm and clear from the beginning that the business would go to Barnaby. And he did give me the latitude of choosing my own husband, instead of ordering me to marry a lordship for aristocratic connections. But yes, I have long wondered why I must content myself with being a spectator to the family enterprise, when I would have much preferred being a participant."
"I thought you were happy with what we have."
Treddles's throat was suddenly dry. "Of course I'm happy with what we have. You are the man I want by my side all my life. But that is not to say I wouldn't have been good at managing and growing the business. And enjoyed that, too."
"Why didn't you tell me earlier?" he wanted to ask. "4 years we've known each other. 3 as man and wife."
His heart was somewhere past his spleen. He felt small and lonely, even though nothing had changed. Nothing at all, except the idea that he, and their life together, was enough for his wife. And so much for his hope that someday he would be able to give her everything she had ever wanted. 21. The note from Lord Ingram came early, before Charlotte had even sat down to breakfast, and it wasn't delivered by post, but via courier. Inspector Treddles's decision to burgle 18 Upper Baker Street did not startle her, though she was surprised by his timing. She'd thought it would be a while longer before he questioned something as fundamental as Sherlock Holmes's gender. The presence of the other intruder, however, did give her pause. Mrs. Marbleton was nothing if not thorough. Sophia Lonsdale was nothing if not thorough. But why? What was the purpose of her involvement? If only Charlotte had access to Ladies Avery and Summersby and could pick their brains of everything they knew about Sophia Lonsdale.
"Good morning, my dear,"
chirped Mrs. Watson, as she sat down and reached for the teapot. She sported a day dress that made Charlotte think of a field of buttercups. Spring, hope, renewal. Being Sherlock Holmes's business partner had made Mrs. Watson busy and buoyant. It gladdened Charlotte to no end that... She mentally smacked herself.
How sloppy of her to overlook a potentially tremendous source of information. Mrs. Watson had told her that the divide between society and the demi-monde was porous. She knew who Charlotte was. She knew the state of Lord Ingram's marriage. Why hadn't Charlotte asked her about Sophia Lonsdale?
Do you know, Mrs. Watson, I recently learned of someone who went through a similar experience as I did, but a generation earlier. She came from a background more prominent than mine. Her family, instead of exiling her to the countryside, disowned her altogether.
Are you speaking of the Lonsdale girl?
Yes, I remember. Quite the scandal back then.
Mrs. Watson's teacup stopped halfway to her lips.
How curious that you should bring her up.
Oh?
Guess who was the man responsible for ruining her?
Charlotte's heart skipped a beat. Could it be? Was Mrs. Watson about to give her the one link that would crack this case wide open?
Who was it?
Mrs. Watson took a sip of her tea.
Lord Sheridan.
For the first time in her life, Charlotte encountered a drawing room that was too gaudy for her. She ran her fingers along the gold tassels of a bright purple lampshade, lifted the edge of a tiger skin rug that draped the back of a red velvet chaise, and tested an even dozen orange and blue pillow cushions for fluffiness. Yes, definitely too gaudy. But if one removed the pillow cushions, not all of them, just 5 or 6, "This is one of Bancroft's places?" she asked Lord Ingram.
"Correct."
"Tell me the truth. Was it a whorehouse under previous ownership?" she asked.
"No, it was a very dull dwelling. Very respectable, I believe."
His answer came with a straight face, but something in his expression made her think that he was trying not to laugh. "Are you saying that Bancroft's minions made changes to the decor?"
"Minions? This is Bancroft's own handiwork."
Charlotte looked around again. "Huh. I never would have guessed Bancroft had such extravagant tastes. He's so colourless."
"You told the poor man to his face that he was the most boring person you'd ever met."
"It was a compliment. He is exactly the faceless bureaucrat you want to be in charge of the inner workings of the Empire. But this parlour is giving me second Wait. Do you mean to tell me that Bancroft fitted out this place to appeal to my tastes when he was courting me?"
"He almost succeeded, didn't he? I told him if he took away half of the cushions, you'd feel right at home."
Charlotte snorted. He knew her too well.
"I also told him not to propose until after he'd first shown you the house, to stack the odds in his favour. He ignored my bang-on advice, of course."
He glanced at her.
"A family trait, that."
Was he referring obliquely to his own dismissal of Charlotte's counsel not to marry the mercenary Lady Ingram?
"I'm almost sorry that he joined the ranks of your rejected suitors," he went on, as if he had at last heard what he'd said and needed to shift the subject. "It would have been a sight, the two of you thrown together for eternity."
"Well, I always say that of all the proposals I've ever received, Bancroft's was my favourite."
"Not because of Bancroft, per se, but because of the effect his suit had on his brother." She would never forget that first simmering silence between them, those ever-expanding ripples of pleasure and pain in her heart, as she listened to the uninterrupted stillness and heard everything he would not say aloud. Sometimes such a silence descended with the grandeur of theatrical curtains. Sometimes it stole upon them like wisps of morning mist. This time she exited her recollection to find herself enveloped in yet another one. He was watching her again, while her face was turned to the red velvet chaise. her fingers playing with the button on a cushion. The doorbell rang, shattering the unquiet silence. Charlotte sat down on the chaise. They greeted a wan-looking Inspector Treddles. Lord Ingram asked the policeman to tell Charlotte what happened the night before at 18 Upper Baker Street, to which she listened with a half-raised brow. There was something not quite right with Inspector Treddles. It was clear he had realized that there was no Sherlock Holmes. It was also clear that he knew the scandal to Charlotte Holmes's name, and he did not approve. By extension, he must approve slightly less of Lord Ingram, whom, until now, he had considered a man without flaws. But none of those reasons, singly or together, could have accounted for his disheartenment. The wonderful beloved wife? Lord Ingram regarded his friend with a neutral expression. He had become much more opaque in recent years, especially since his estrangement from his own wife. When Inspector Treddles finished relating the events of the previous evening, Lord Ingram brought out a stack of prints he'd made from the negatives he'd stolen from the Marbletons.
"Is this the man you saw at Baker Street?" he asked, showing Inspector Treddles an image of Stephen Marbleton. "No, the man had a beard."
Lord Ingram handed over another photograph, the same young man wearing the same clothes and standing in the same place with the same pose, only now sporting a luxuriant beard. This caught Inspector Treddles's attention. He examined the photograph with much greater attention.
"I've heard of the manipulation that can be done to photographs, but I've never seen it with my own eyes. I used to distribute prints of my brother Bancroft with horns on his head. To date, I remain his favourite brother," said Lord Ingram dryly. "But I take it that's still not the man you saw?" "No, I don't believe so."
"This one?" Lord Ingram handed over yet another photograph of a bearded young man. Charlotte's eyes widened. This man had on a lounge suit and was casually posed, beard and all, but his features were those of Francis Marbleton's.
"Yes, him," said Treddles. "I spoke to Mr. Shrewsbury this morning before church," said Lord Ingram. "This is also the person he believes to have been driving the hansom cab that his mother inexplicably rode in the night before she died."
Inspector Treddles studied the photographs again, one by one.
"I will have someone show these pictures to the villagers. Do you know yet what might have been their motive?"
"I spoke with Mrs. Watson this morning," said Charlotte, "and learned that the lover who ruined Sophia Lonsdale was said to be none other than Lord Sheridan."
Lord Ingram frowned. "He must be a good 25 years older than her."
"She was one of his daughter's closest friends. Mrs. Watson's understanding is that their grief drew them closer and one day mutual comforting went too far," Charlotte explained. "But let's consider a slightly different scenario. What if the man who ruined her had been Mr. Sackville instead? If Lord Sheridan took the blame for his brother, that could explain their subsequent alienation. Here's something else I learned from Mrs. Watson. Lady Shrewsbury had been the one to broadcast Sophia Lonsdale's indiscretion. And if Lord Ingram gets hold of Lady Avery or Lady Summersby, it's quite possible he could unearth some connection between Lady Amelia Drummond and Sophia Lonsdale, too. In this scenario, Sophia Lonsdale would have ample reason to swoop in, cold-blooded murders on her mind, for the wrongs she perceived her victims had perpetrated against her all those years ago. For a fall from grace so complete that decades later she still carried discoloration on her hands." Lord Ingram cradled his chin in the space between his thumb and forefinger.
"This would have been a perfect explanation. Why don't you sound more convinced?
Because I don't understand Lady Sheridan's involvement in the present day. I feel we're still nowhere near the bottom of what she'd been trying to do on that trip to...
She fell silent.
There was something she'd learned from Inspector Treddles's reports, the ones he had handed over for Sherlock Holmes to read during his first visit.
What was it?
Her palm struck the tufted surface of the velvet chaise. Inspector, when you interviewed Dr. Birch, the physician from the next village who was summoned because Dr. Harris was out, he mentioned that he had his dog cart already hitched because he was headed out to the village inn to see to an elderly traveller in need of morphine. I believe you can find Lady Sheridan's picture in recent Bath papers from the opening of the new YWCA centre. And I believe if you were to show her picture to both Dr. Birch and the innkeeper, they would confirm that she is the elderly traveller in question.
Sergeant MacDonald was dispatched to Devon that same afternoon. By mid-morning the following day, he was wiring back reports. The young Marbletons were indeed recognised as the travelling photographer and his assistant, who had come through the village. Inspector Treddles sent a pair of constables to Claridge's, but they telephoned from the hotel, reporting that the Marbletons had already vacated their suite and left no forwarding addresses. Within a quarter hour, Sergeant MacDonald's next report came.
Dear Inspector Treddles, I spoke to Dr. Birch and his sister Miss Birch. They both identified Lady Sheridan as Mrs. Broadbent, the elderly patient staying at the inn in Barton Cross. Since Dr. Birch had to rush out to Curry House, Miss Birch was the one who took the morphine to the inn and administered it to Lady Sheridan. When Dr. Birch came back from Curry House and called on Lady Sheridan, she was better thanks to the morphine, though still in a state of great suffering. As he recounted what had kept him from seeing her sooner, she became more animated and asked a number of questions. Dr. Birch doesn't recall whether he used Mr. Sackville's name in his exchange with Lady Sheridan. He thinks he might have. Miss Birch had this to add. After she administered the morphine, Lady Sheridan asked her to retrieve a framed photograph of her daughter from her reticule. And when Miss Birch reached in, the first thing she felt was not a photograph, but a pistol. Yours truly, MacDonald.
When Inspector Treddles arrived at the Sheridan townhouse, Mr. Addison conducted him not to the drawing room, but Lady Sheridan's bedroom.
"The doctor has just been. She doesn't have long to live," said the butler, looking much less spry than Treddles remembered from mere days ago. "Please be brief, Inspector."
Lady Sheridan lay in a half recline, a hillock of pillows behind her back. Her grey hair was loose, her cheeks waxy, her eyes deeply sunken. At Treddles's entrance, she signalled a white-capped nurse, who had been feeding her spoonfuls of broth, to leave.
"I'm afraid I won't be able to answer many questions, Inspector," she said slowly. "I've had quite a bit of laudanum."
"I'll be quick then, ma'am. How do you explain your presence in the next nearest village to Curry House at the same time Mr. Sackville died?"
"Coincidence. I might die any minute. For old time's sake, I wished to see my brother-in-law one last time."
"Why did you choose to do so alone? Why not bring along Lord Sheridan?"
She snorted, a sound of bitterness.
"He isn't about to die."
"If a social call had indeed been your only purpose, why lie about something so simple and understandable?"
"If I didn't, Lord Sheridan would know, wouldn't he?"
Her eyelids drooped. When she looked at Treddles again, the simple action seemed to require superhuman effort.
"He'd have asked me why I must undermine his proud estrangement from his brother, and I hadn't enough time left to bother with that sort of nonsense.
And the pistol you carried with you on the trip?
This time she closed her eyes, a strange little smile about her lips.
A lady must take care when she travels by herself.
Shortly after Treddles had been promoted to sergeant, he returned to Barrow Inverness to visit his mother. She had been in robust health, but as he said goodbye to her, he'd had a sense of foreboding that it would be the last time he saw her. She'd died mere weeks later from a sudden and fierce fever. In the hours before his father-in-law drew his last breath, everyone had been convinced that he would fully recover, especially Alice. But Treddles had the same premonition. Mr. Cousin had died that night. There would be no further questions for Lady Sheridan. Their final meeting was at an end. He bowed.
Thank you, ma'am. Goodbye.
Upon Inspector Treddles's return to Scotland Yard, he found Hodges's written statement at his desk. Treddles filliped the piece of paper. Something about the handwriting snagged his attention. The oddly crooked G's, the squashed O's, and the majuscule A's that were more ambitious than necessary. Where had he seen this handwriting before? Then he looked at what Hodges had actually written. He'd been staying at an inn in Camberwell, which was in London, very far from the Isle of Wight, the supposed destination for his holidays, but very close to Lambeth, where Mr. Sackville had visited twice a month for at least 7 years running. Treddles leapt up and pulled open the file case where he kept his official correspondence. Yes, there were those two letters he'd received about the House of Ill Repute in Lambeth. The exact same handwriting. The first letter was rather vague. The second, which he'd received 2 months ago, was full of anger and anguish, all but screaming into the void, warning of pure depravity, the exploitation of the most innocent and helpless, etc. He rushed out to Lambeth, to the lane named in the letter, and stood before the skeletal remains of what must have been a structure big enough for a family of 12. He'd been there no more than a few minutes before he realized that the house next door had an unusually large number of men hurrying in and out. "Not that news from home is much better," Alice had said on the night of Holmes's misfortune, sitting at the edge of Treddles's desk and flipping through the evening papers. "Recriminations over the failure of the Irish Home Rule Bill? Police still looking for suspects in the fire in Lambeth that destroyed a building and killed two?"
And what had he said to her?
"I know about that building in Lambeth. Every last inspector in Scotland Yard got letters about it. And it isn't even a copper hell, but a bookmaker's. You close one down and it opens right back up two streets over."
The neighbouring house was the bookmaker's place, and the men who barged in and out the runners who collected bets and settled winnings. What then had been the depravities committed in the house that had been burned to the ground? What kind of depravities would turn a man like Hodges, who must have seen a fair bit of the seedier side of life, into a rabid crusader? Treddles ordered Hodges arrested and brought to London. Sergeant MacDonald delivered the valet into Treddles's keeping late that evening. This time Hodges didn't look so natty. There was something about being arrested and put under the power of the Crown that stripped jauntiness from a man, a state of vulnerability that was not helped by the blank, sterile walls of an interrogation room.
"Mr. Hodges, you were the one who poisoned Mr. Sackville. You were outraged at what went on in that house in Lambeth he visited. You gave him arsenic, coinciding with the timing of his trips to London, so that he would suffer and not be able to achieve what he set out to do."
"You can't prove anything,"
The absence of jauntiness did not imply the absence of defiance.
No, but I have here a sample of your writing, and every inspector at Scotland Yard has received letters from you, screaming about the intolerable deeds that went on inside the house. And then the house mysteriously went up in smoke, resulting in two deaths. That is enough ground to charge you with arson and murder, Mr. Hodges.
Scotland Yard certainly didn't have any other suspects. The investigation had been ongoing for weeks, and the officer in charge still couldn't be sure how many people had lived inside, or what it had been used for, before it was reduced to ashes and rubble.
"I didn't burn down the house," Hodges answered through clenched teeth.
"You will have a difficult time proving that.
I was in Devon. You could have had accomplices in London." "I would never do such a thing. There were children inside. Little children!"
Hodges's outburst ricocheted in the room. His hands balled into fists, and he panted as if he'd run all the way from Curry House. Treddles felt as if he'd been picked up, turned upside down, and shaken violently.
"Tell me about those children," he said,
his voice sounding curiously disembodied.
"The little girl they brought me wasn't even 9. She said she'd been in that house for a whole year, at least. And she told me that there were boys and girls at least 3 years younger than her."
Hodges's throat worked.
"Yes, I gave him arsenic before his next trip. But I didn't want to kill him. I'm not a murderer. I wanted to buy some time for the police to do something, anything."
"You had the wrong house number in your letters."
Hodges dropped his head into his hands. It had been an easy enough mistake. Of the two houses, only one had its number on the exterior, and though it seemed to be right in the middle between the two entrances, the number had belonged to the bookmaker.
"When did you decide to change to chloral?"
Treddles still sounded dispassionate. Times like this, it was as if some mechanism deep inside him roared to life and insulated him in a thick layer of numbness.
"I never had anything to do with the chloral. I was gone that week, in London. I went to see if there was anything I could do to close the place down, but when I got there, it had already burned to the ground."
Hodges wiped the heel of his hand across his eyes.
"And no one knew what happened to the children. No one."
The next morning, Treddles returned to 18 Upper Baker Street. He noticed that the manservant who conducted him to the flat was the same one who had opened the door for him the other day at the lurid house where he last met with Lord Ingram and Miss Holmes. On loan from Lord Ingram, to keep an eye on Miss Holmes's safety, no doubt. Miss Holmes greeted him solemnly. It had been excruciating to come before her at their previous meeting, knowing that her wide-set, innocent-seeming eyes would have remarked every ounce of his inner distress. But now he barely cared. Now the numbness reigned. He stated what Hodges had revealed at Scotland Yard, something his normal self would have tried his best to shield from the hearing of a lady. She listened without moving, not even to pour tea, and remained still for long minutes afterward. Vaguely he wondered whether it had been too much for her, whether her woman's mind could not handle iniquities of this magnitude without going to pieces.
"What Becky Birtles said," she murmured. "It's so obvious in hindsight. Mr. Sackville was only interested in her because she was small and underdeveloped and he thought her still prepubescent. When it turned out she already had menses, he lost all in—"
She sprang out of her chair. "The Sheridan's daughter. How did she die?"
He rose hastily.
Sergeant MacDonald looked it up and copied down what had been written on her death certificate. I have it with me. He opened the document case he carried. Congestive heart failure, signed by Dr. Bernard Motley. But he is Mrs. Treadles's family physician. Miss Holmes all but ripped the piece of paper from him. She stared down at it, a fierce frown on her face.
Do you remember the case you had sent me via Lord Ingram? The curious case of a young girl related by none other than this Dr. Motley?
The one you believe to have killed herself by smuggling frozen carbon dioxide to her room.
What did that have to do with anything? Did the Sheridan household have a ready supply of carbon dioxide?
I spoke to the Sheridan's butler. He mentioned they used to have canisters of gas for carbonating water.
It was her. Clara Sackville killed herself.
Her voice was firm, implacable. The implication of her words at last penetrated past the shield of numbness. Are you saying that Mr. Sackville did something to his niece? His own niece? When she was a little girl?
Miss Holmes returned to her seat, lifted the teapot, and poured, her hands perfectly steady, while Treadles scrambled to reassemble his protective cocoon. And Sophia Lonsdale was one of her best friends.
Treadles was still reeling. She killed Mr. Sackville for Clara.
It would explain the pistol in Lady Sheridan's reticule, wouldn't it? She would have done it herself, but he already died before she had the chance to confront him.
A knock came at the door. Miss Holmes, said the manservant. Something came in the post. You said to bring everything to you right away.
Yes, thank you, Barclay.
She scanned the envelope.
Mrs. Marbleton. My name and address have been typed on the same typewriter she used to produce her first cipher for me to solve. Let's see what she wants to tell me.
Dear Miss Holmes, 2 months ago I returned to Britain for the first time in many years to see an old friend on her deathbed. Before she passed away, she gave me a diary from another old friend who departed many years ago. My dying friend had never read Clara Sackville's diary, as Clara had asked her not to open it until her parents had both passed on. No other person of my acquaintance holds to her word as firmly as my friend did. I know, because she had long kept my secrets. But I have never been as resistant to curiosity. After my friend's funeral, I read Clara's diary. As I did so, I wept, screamed, threw an inkwell across the room in anger, and shook at the cruelty and injustice in this world, and despised myself for never having guessed anything remotely near the incestuous truth. Clara loved and trusted her uncle. He exploited that trust and love and twisted her innate desire to please. I cannot bear to think of how lonely and frightened she must have been. When he used her to satisfy some warped part of himself, he forever isolated her from everyone and everything else she held dear. The more she descended into her private hell, the more she tried to love him. Love was her defense against the judgment that was to come. Love was the only excuse. But as soon as she entered puberty, he had no more use for her. It annihilated her. The betrayal of trust, the belief that she had done the abominable in the eyes of God, the knowledge that she would have carried on doing the same if he hadn't abandoned her. Not to mention the fact that he was family, and that everyone, especially her parents, still expected her to be terribly fond of this uncle. That she did not destroy the diary tells me that she wished for the truth to be known some day. So I proceeded accordingly. The choice was left to Mr. Sackville. He could choose to face exposure,
or he could choose to not face it. As for the women whose deaths you've connected to his, yes, indeed, there was a connection. Lady Amelia and Lady Shrewsbury came upon Clara and Mr. Sackville. Clara recorded that she was terrified they would inform her parents, but her uncle assured her that it would not come to pass. Lady Amelia's husband owed Mr. Sackville a ruinous amount of money. Lady Shrewsbury was not in financial distress, but she was a social climbing toady who didn't have enough character to gainsay Lady Amelia. The incident took place when Clara was a few months short of 11. These women failed her utterly. They did nothing to protect her from Mr. Sackville's predation, then or ever. I offered them the same choice as I did Mr. Sackville. They all chose chloral. Cowards, one and all. Lady Sheridan died in the night. Expect the matter to be made public soon. Yours truly, an admirer. P.S. Best of luck with life as Sherlock Holmes. P.P.S. I have taken temporary custody of the children from the house Mr. Sackville frequented in London. I hope they, or some of them at least, will grow up and be well. P.P.P.S. Lady Sheridan and I ran into each other quite by chance. I have the habit of investigating establishments that purport to help women. She had long been a patroness to the YWCA. We met each other outside the Association's Institute in Bethnal Green, not a place I expected to encounter society ladies. Recognition shocked us both, but almost immediately we began to speak. I had always regretted the injury I must have caused her. Unbeknownst to me, she had devoted herself to the welfare of vulnerable young women because of the harsh fate I had met with, which she felt was far more punishment than I deserved. At some point in the conversation we began reminiscing about Clara. She told me that she had never believed in the explanation the physician had offered, but only pretended to do so for her husband's sake. Clara had been far from well. Lady Sheridan had tried everything in her power to uplift the girl's spirit and blamed herself for failing. I debated with myself, but in the end decided to tell her the truth, and assured her that I would not let the guilty parties go free. But Lady Sheridan had decided to take matters into her own hands anyway, and it was only the full execution of Sophia Lonsdale's plan that had prevented her from committing murder at the end of her life.
So all three of them took the chloral themselves, Treddles heard himself murmur.
Sophia Lonsdale must have been in the hansom cab Lady Shrewsbury got into the night before her death, said Miss Holmes. I wonder that she didn't also confront Lady Amelia in person.
But there is no evidence of her having been in the vicinity of Curry House.
I believe when the young Marbletons reported on how difficult it is for a stranger to go unnoticed in the area, she opted for the postal service instead. It can't be difficult to have her package resemble from the outside a wrapped magazine or some such, so that the servants would pay it no mind. The worst that could happen would be that someone finds a typed unsigned letter detailing Mr. Sackville's perversions. But, of course, Mr. Sackville would have destroyed everything.
Treddles nodded. Do you think Sophia Lonsdale was in a hurry at the end? Almost a fortnight passed between Lady Amelia's death and Mr. Sackville's, but only a day elapsed between Mr. Sackville's and Lady Shrewsbury's.
It's possible she became impatient. It's also possible she wished to take advantage of my scandal.
Miss Holmes smiled slightly.
Seems more plausible to have a healthy woman die in her sleep when she'd been greatly angered by her son than for no reason at all.
Treddles had no idea what he could say in response. He did not understand Miss Holmes's scandal.
It made no sense how such a diamond-bright mind could have made such foolish, downright immoral decisions. She took a sip of her tea. What of the valet, Hodges? What will happen to him?
He was glad to move away from the subject of her carnal weakness. I do not believe Lord Sheridan, when he learns the truth, will wish to prosecute. And if he declines, I have no reason to believe Scotland Yard would take on the task. Miss Holmes folded the letter and carefully placed it back in its envelope.
I have a presentiment that in revealing Clara's tragedy, Sophia Lonsdale will credit her dead friend, the one who had held Clara Sackville's diary for many years, with the plan for vengeance, so as to keep her own name out of the news. No woman goes to the trouble of staging her own death without a compelling reason. Inspector, would you please keep her involvement in the case out of public knowledge?
Treddles considered a moment before saying, I will.
I'm greatly indebted to you, Inspector, for your gallant assistance in this case.
Treddles inclined his head and rose. It was not Miss Holmes's fault that what he'd always believed about his wife turned out to be not exactly the case, but all the same he was ready not to have anything to do with Sherlock Holmes for a good long while. As if she'd heard every thought in his head, Miss Holmes set a prettily wrapped package in his hands.
The Madeleine are for Mrs. Treddles. Please convey my warmest regards to her.
22.
You know what I have been thinking? Asked Livia.
They were seated at the refreshments area set aside for the reading room patrons at the British Museum. Charlotte had resumed her weekly trip to the reading room, and Livia had snuck out of a skull-numbing garden party to visit with her favourite sister.
What have you been thinking? Asked Charlotte.
She looked well, her serene, cherubic self. More than one gentleman had walked past their table unnecessarily, studying her out of the corner of his eyes. Life had improved drastically for Livia, too, since it finally became known that Lady Shrewsbury and Lady Amelia had committed suicide to avoid public shame. Of course, Charlotte's absence was always an ache in the heart, and Livia dreaded the long months in the country after the end of the season. But to be free of suspicions at last, to no longer live under that dark cloud hanging over her head, it was a pleasure well worth savouring. And of course, Charlotte now had an income. Her latest case earned a whopping 4 quid 10 shillings, much to Livia's heart-palpitating joy.
I have become much thriftier, Charlotte wrote in one of her letters. I'm determined to accumulate enough to provide for all of us, you, me, and Bernardine.
Livia wiped her fingers on a napkin.
I think you should publish some of Sherlock Holmes's cases. Those accounts would be far better publicity for your services than newspaper adverts.
Charlotte put another half sandwich on Livia's plate.
But by coming to a private consultant, my clients expect a certain amount of privacy. Change their names. Then no one will be the wiser.
Charlotte shook her head.
The only case I've been a part of that has the makings of a proper narrative is the Sackville case. Even if I changed the name of everyone involved, people would still already know what happened. Not to mention magazines that might want to publish such accounts would shy away from that particular one, for fear of offending the sensibility of their readers.
Livia was undeterred.
Then fictionalize it. Take the bones of the story and rebuild it. Sherlock Holmes is asked by Scotland Yard to help with a suspicious death. You can keep the method of the killing, but change chloral to some other poison. And you can also have the murderer come to you by means of a newspaper notice.
except somewhat differently, of course.
I like it,
Charlotte grinned.
And what would this person be avenging?
At the bright interest in her sister's eyes, Livia's mind suddenly swarmed with ideas.
That would be the easiest thing to come up with, wouldn't it? People are always doing horrible things to each other. In fact, last week I read a book by Mr. Twain, and it mentioned a massacre that took place in Utah a generation ago. The local militia killed more than 100 people from a wagon train headed to California. You can have someone who survived the massacre tracking down those responsible for it.
All the way to London?
Why not?
Livia reached for the half-sandwich Charlotte had given her and took a bite.
Ah, everything tasted so much better when Charlotte was at the table. The world is a small place nowadays, and it would also be in keeping with the spirit of the original case, that of an avenger coming from abroad.
A workable idea, Charlotte pronounced, taking a sip of her lemonade. Livia almost preened. Charlotte didn't give false compliments. If she said the idea was workable, then it was workable.
You will do it, then?
Charlotte shook her head. You should write this story, Livia.
Me?
Yes, you.
But I've never written anything before.
That isn't entirely true.
Of course Charlotte would know about Livia's notebooks, filled with half-germinated ideas and stories that had fallen apart a few pages in.
Livia's face heated. She ought to have burned those notebooks. It was too embarrassing for her amateurish efforts to have been seen by anyone, even if it was only Charlotte.
"Remember when you read Poe's The Murders in the Rue Morgue?" asked Charlotte. "Remember how outraged you were? That after all the tension and excitement of the premise, in the denouement Mr. Poe couldn't do better than a crazed orangutan? You were scribbling in your notebook for days afterward."
"Yes, but it's much easier to condemn him for using a crazed orangutan than to come up with a better story myself."
Charlotte refilled Livia's glass of lemonade.
"I never told you this, but some of your openings were more than decent. I wish you'd have continued with those stories."
Livia's heart thudded. She was good at something.
"Anyway, give this Sherlock Holmes story a try," Charlotte said firmly, as she pushed a plate of sponge cake in Livia's direction.
"You'll surprise yourself."
Charlotte returned from the British Museum in time for her last appointment of the day at 18 Upper Baker Street. At precisely 7:30, the bell rang. A few seconds later, a cheerful-looking young woman entered the parlour.
"Miss Oxford, how do you do?"
"Very well, thank you." Miss Oxford shook Charlotte's hand vigorously and with a wide smile. "I'm pleased to be here." Her unencumbered high spirits struck Charlotte. Her clients typically betrayed some signs of anxiety. The usual pantomime about Sherlock Holmes's disability ensued. Miss Oxford, after expressing her sympathy, declared emphatically that, yes, she wished for a demonstration of Mr. Holmes's mental prowess. Charlotte looked her over. Then she walked to the sideboard and produced two glasses of whiskey.
"You're a Londoner, born and brought up in this very area. But you've been abroad recently and only just returned. Paris, I would say. You weren't a tourist there. You didn't hold any positions. Nor were you living with family or friends. Which leads me to conclude that you are a student of medicine at the Sorbonne."
She handed a glass of whiskey to her client and raised her own.
"Welcome home, Miss Redmayne."
Miss Redmayne burst into a peal of laughter.
"What gave me away? Is it the family resemblance? Everybody always says I take after my aunt."
"There is a good likeness.
The more Charlotte looked at her, however, the more Miss Redmayne began to resemble someone else. The late Duke of Wycliffe, Lord Ingram's father, or at least his official father. Charlotte had always assumed that Miss Redmayne wasn't Mrs. Watson's niece, but the latter's daughter. Easier on everyone that way, and the girl could go about with a gloss of legitimacy. She had further assumed that Miss Redmayne's father was a man of considerable wealth. John Watson, an army doctor, would not have been able to provide for his widow in as comfortable a manner. She had, however, never imagined there to be connections between Mrs. Watson and the Ashburtons. Miss Redmayne merrily chatted away. Charlotte knew she must be making the correct responses, for Miss Redmayne laughed and continued talking. But Charlotte's head spun. It wasn't uncommon for children to develop a rapport with their father's mistress, especially if they had already lost their mother. J.H.R., the mysterious entity to whom Lord Ingram's book had been dedicated, was none other than Joanna Hamish Redmayne, otherwise known as Mrs. Watson. She wasn't someone he disapproved of hugely, but a friend and confidant of long standing. And Mrs. Watson hadn't run into Charlotte by accident at the post office. She had been sent. Miss Redmayne stopped and looked at Charlotte expectantly. Charlotte made a concerted effort to recall what had been said to her. "I can't declare with 100% confidence that I would have enjoyed dissection, but I'd like to think I wouldn't faint more than 2 or 3 times before I became used to it." Miss Redmayne chortled and launched into another anecdote from her anatomy class. Charlotte forced herself to pay attention and keep up with the discussion. A quarter of an hour must have passed before Miss Redmayne said, "Well, shall we go home? My aunt promised there will be a magnificent bottle of champagne waiting." "Why don't you go first? I have a bit of preparation that needs to be done before I'm ready for my first client tomorrow." After making Charlotte promise she won't be long, Miss Redmayne flounced down the steps. Charlotte returned to her seat and sank down heavily. A knock came at the door. Charlotte started. "Who is it?" Lord Ingram walked in. Charlotte was instantly on her feet. "What are you doing here?"
"You wrote me."
He studied her closely, but with a measure of caution. Did he know? Had he taken one look at her and realized that she now knew what he had orchestrated? She searched his face, but it did not reveal what he was thinking.
"Yes, I wrote you, but I didn't request to see you."
She had gone to Somerset House, found the name of Sophia Lonsdale's husband in the wedding registry, and asked Lord Ingram whether he knew anything about the man Sophia Lonsdale had taken such pains to leave behind.
"I met with Bancroft just now."
He spoke with an exaggerated calm, as if he were bracing himself for trouble.
"What he told me you need to hear right away."
She didn't give a farthing for what Lord Bancroft had to say. Instead, she closed the distance between them and jabbed a finger into his chest. "You lied to me. You did have me followed." He did not answer immediately, but looked at her, not scrutinizing her for clues, just taking her in, feature by feature.
"I have said a great many things to you that are convenient rather than truthful."
His dark eyes were turning darker. His gaze travelled from her eyes to her lips and back again. She was even closer to him than she'd thought. They were practically touching, separated by scant molecules of air. She inhaled the sandalwood scent of his shaving soap and the fragrance of clean, warm skin.
"And I only had you followed until you became Mrs. Watson's companion. After that, it was all Mrs. Marbleton. Or I should say, Mrs. Mo—" She kissed him,
He stood stock still for a moment. Then he yanked her to him, cupped her face, and kissed her back with the force of Zeus's thunderbolts striking ground. Sweet, bitter, pleasure, pain, and then only fierce, mindless sensations, only heat and electricity. She was panting for a while before she realized that the kiss had ended, that she stood with her cheek against the lapel of his coat, listening to the fast, strong beat of his heart. He took a step back. She sighed. Every sublime moment must come with a bereft hour. He didn't need to address the matter for her to understand that even though everything had changed, nothing had changed.
"I hope you will not be angry at Mrs. Watson," he said quietly. "All I asked was that she pass on some funds to you. Welcoming you into her house and then taking you on as a business partner, those were her own decisions."
The direction of his gaze, on the floor next to her feet, the placement of his hands, gripping the gloves he'd taken off as he came into the room, the rise and fall of his chest was rapid, agitated. He was waiting for her verdict. "I am not angry at Mrs. Watson." He did not relax. In fact, he appeared more tense. They both knew she could never be angry at Mrs. Watson. But what about at him? Her former partner in silence. Was she angry that he thought nothing of overstepping his bounds when he believed it necessary, only to now withdraw behind long-established lines of separation? She sighed again. "What was it you were going to tell me about the tutor Sophia Lonsdale married?" He gazed at her another moment.
"Moriarty. Only that it gave Bancroft quite a turn to hear that name. He kept asking how I'd learned about the man, and when he was finally convinced that I wasn't personally embroiled with Moriarty, warned me in no uncertain terms never to be."
Charlotte's heart stopped momentarily. Thank goodness he'd said no to her idea of writing to Lady Summersby and have her identify Mrs. Marbleton.
"And this reminds me, Holmes."
He reached into his pocket and pulled out an envelope.
"Bancroft asked me to give this to you."
Her heart thudded. She'd feared he would never call her Holmes again. "He is not in need of a mistress, is he?" she murmured, just to see Lord Ingram roll his eyes. The note read,
"Dear Mr. Holmes, I've watched your consulting service with great interest, and would like to call on you tomorrow morning at 10 to discuss a matter of great delicacy and importance. Should you choose to accept the commission, it would require you to work closely with my brother, Lord Ingram Ashburton. I hope I will be able to secure your assistance. Yours truly, Bancroft Ashburton."
Trust Lord Bancroft to know how to set a lure. She burned the note, because that was what Lord Ingram had told her one did with any communication from his brother. Then she said to Lord Ingram, "Tell Lord Bancroft that he had better keep his promise, and that I will see him not at 10, but at 11. He shook his head, but his expression was gentle, almost affectionate.
"I was always afraid this day would come, that Bancroft would discover you for your mind."
"When did you discover me for my mind, Ash?" she asked impulsively. He already had one hand on the door. Looking back at her, he said,
"From the beginning, Holmes. The very beginning."
This concludes the reading of A Study in Scarlet Women by Sherry Thomas. Copyright 2016 by Sherry Thomas. This book was read by Kate Redding. This unabridged audiobook was recorded by arrangement with the Berkeley Publishing Group, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC,
and was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright.